The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. When Ohio resident Jeremy Bennett asked a state officer to come back and conduct an inspection of his taxidermy business when it was open for the season, he had no idea his request would lead to criminal prosecution. Unfortunately, for many businesses, warrantless inspections like the one Jeremy experienced are a familiar cost of doing business. But should they be? I'm here with IJ attorney Josh Windham and senior attorney Rob Frommer to discuss when government officials can come into your business without a warrant, how the courts open the door to a troubling disregard for property rights, and what they need to do to fix things. Josh, let's start with what happened to Jeremy. Taxidermy might not be a business that is familiar to some of our listeners, but I suspect that they will actually find most of Jeremy's story very relatable.
I think so, too. Jeremy is what you might call a self-made man. He lives in rural Logan, Ohio, and in the late 90s, he was in high school, and he started practicing taxidermy out of his parents' basement, actually. He taught himself the trade. He was sort of a lifelong hunter, and so he decided, well, I want to pick this up and see if I can make some money off it, right? And after graduating high school, he kept doing it sort of on the side. His parents gifted him some land as a graduation gift right down the street from them. And, you know, he started a family there. He built his own house. He married his wife, and he and his wife lived there. And he started a landscaping and lawn care business. That was his family's primary income for a while. And after a few years, you know, he kept doing taxidermy on the side in his own basement. And after a few years, he decided, you know what? I'm going to take the leap and start my own full-time taxidermy business and make this the basis of my family's full-time income. And he did it. And it was a huge success. And he ended up having enough success that he could build the shop right across the street from his house, right across the driveway, actually, just a few dozen feet away. And he built the shop by hand, too. And so what we're talking about here is a small little residential property where everything is built by Jeremy's two hands of his own design, including this business. And the business grows over time, and he's getting more and more customers and gaining respect in the area. Eventually, he realizes, wow, there's a demand for deer processing, too, which kind of goes hand in hand with hunting, or taxidermy, rather. And deer processing is really just serving as like the neighborhood deer butcher, right? So when Hunter comes in and brings deer to Jeremy, Jeremy then, you know, processes the meat for that hunter, and they can then eat the venison, you know, sausage, that kind of stuff. So they're not wasting any meat. And so this is Jeremy's business. He's a joint deer processor and taxidermist. Now, where the government comes into this story is that the state doesn't regulate these businesses at all in terms of the conduct of taxidermy or deer processing. But what it does require is that taxidermists and deer processors keep records. And they're basically required to keep records of who brought the animal in and when the animal leaves and a few other details. But in short, like, they have to keep in and out records of these animals so that the state knows, you know, like, what's coming in and what's going out. Hunting is itself regulated, and so this is part of the regulation of hunting. And as part of this records keeping requirement, the state has a regulation that empowers state inspectors to come in without consent and without a warrant, and to inspect Jeremy's shop to make sure he's keeping accurate records. And for a long time, about 15 years, Jeremy didn't really have issues with the inspectors who came to his shop. He was on pretty good terms with them, and they would come in and just sort of pop in the front area of his shop and flip through the records and say, well, everything looks to be in order. See you later. And that was about it. And Jeremy never really thought twice of it. Until a new inspector was appointed to his area about 10 years ago. And this inspector seemed to have a bee in his bonnet. He had a bit of a head on his shoulders, and he decided to kind of treat Jeremy as presumptively guilty of records-keeping violations and other kinds of violations until Jeremy could prove himself innocent. And so the inspector would come in and spend hours, you know, kind of wandering around Jeremy's shop looking for things to ding him on, looking for things that Jeremy might have been doing wrong. He would open cabinets, he would open drawers, he would go in freezers and pull out meat and lay it out all over the floor in such a way that Jeremy couldn't actually get it back in because, you know, when you take frozen things out of the freezer, it starts to thaw and it's hard to get things back in the same shape that it was there in before, right? And so ultimately, this is a huge disruption. And I'll just give a few examples. In 2016, Jeremy has 5 kids by this point, and they're all, I think the oldest is 13. He and his wife homeschooled their kids. They sometimes use Jeremy's taxidermy shop for homeschooling lessons. Like if one of the kids needs to be separated and do a special lesson on their own, they'll go to the shop while Jeremy's working and do a lesson there while the other kids are in the house, right? And so in 2016, one of the kids went into Jeremy's shop, and the inspector was on the property, saw the kid enter the shop and followed him in the shop. And he treated that kid's decision to enter the shop to go hang out with his dad as, well, he's inviting me in. So the inspector follows the kid in the shop and then he wanders into the non-public area of Jeremy's shop. So there are signs up that say, you know, employees only pass this point, non-public space, basically don't enter unless you have my permission, right, as the owner of the shop. And he just starts wandering around that workspace and opening cabinets, opening drawers. And Jeremy says, hey, can I help you find something? And the inspector says, no, I'm just doing my inspection. And Jeremy's like, well, if you tell me what you're looking for, I can probably help you find it a bit easier. And the guy says, well, I'll know it when I see it. And Jeremy kind of chafes and says, well, I don't really care for that attitude, you know? And the inspector says, well, everybody does something wrong. We just need to find out what you did. And that is the typical perspective and tone of these inspections for Jeremy over the past decade. And this all kind of culminated last year in the incident that triggered the case that we filed. And what happened in this incident was the officers, this guy and a trainee came by Jeremy's shop in December of 2020. This was the height of deer hunting season when Jeremy's doing deer processing primarily. He keeps his taxidermy studio closed while he's doing deer processing, right? And so during this period, you know, the top part of his shop where all the taxidermy work happens is used for storage. It's not used for business. Only the bottom part of the shop is open. So the inspectors come by and the primary officer says, okay, we're going to be doing an inspection. And, you know, they spend about an hour going through the deer processing area and, you know, doing the whole rigmarole, looking through records, opening coolers and wandering in and out and taking meat out and all of that. It's very disruptive to Jeremy's business at a time, by the way, when he's missing employees because of COVID. He's short-staffed by 3 employees because of COVID. And so he's really busy and he's hoping to speed this along. At the end of this, about 45 minutes in, the inspector says, all right, well, we'd like to see the taxidermy studio upstairs. And Jeremy says, you know, it's not open right now. It's really a mess. It's just being used for storage. You know, you're welcome to come back in a few weeks when we're open, but, you know, I just have to get on with my day. And the inspector kind of says, okay, you're sure? You know, he asks a couple times and Jeremy offers repeatedly to go get him anything he's looking for. You know, if you want a specific thing, I'm happy to go grab it for you and show it to you. But I just don't want you rifling through this area that's really messy and being used for storage right now. And so the inspector basically says, okay. And that's, Jeremy thinks that's the end of it. He ends up leaving. Jeremy wipes his hand clean of the interaction and he goes on with his day. Well, a few months later, an investigator from the Ohio Division of Wildlife comes to Jeremy's shop and says, hey, do you have a minute? And Jeremy's like, sure. And he walks into the shop and says, you're being charged, criminally prosecuted for not allowing that inspection, for refusing an inspection. And it's true that under the law, it's a misdemeanor in Ohio to refuse one of these inspections, one of these warrantless, non-consensual inspections. And that if you do refuse, you can be charged up to $1,000 and be thrown in jail for up to 6 months. And so Jeremy had to go through the process of defending himself, essentially for standing on his constitutional rights. And he ended up entering into a settlement agreement, paying $150 fine and not serving any jail time. But that was the end of that. And of course, you know, after all that happened, we got in contact with Jeremy and we decided this system sounds bonkers. It sounds like it violates the Fourth Amendment, and we're going to do something about it.
Well, as it happens, we actually have an audio recording of the state official coming into Jeremy's shop and telling him that they were bringing criminal charges against him. I'd like to play that now.
Mr. Bennett?
That's me.
I'm an investigator with the Ohio Division of Wildlife.
Okay. How are you?
The prosecutor's office approved a couple charges for not allowing that inspection.
If I had any inkling that I was doing anything illegal and saying that you couldn't come upstairs, we'd have came upstairs. Mm-hmm. I had no clue that I was violating anything.
He has the authority, by the way the laws are, to, in essence, look anywhere he wants.
So, Rob, is what the officer says in that clip true? A government official coming into Jeremy's shop can just look wherever he wants?
No, that's absolutely not the case. The Fourth Amendment protects our right to be secure. And you don't lose your Fourth Amendment rights just because you open up a business. Businesses, just like people, have Fourth Amendment rights. That's the reason we brought this case. The government here is saying that they can barge into Jeremy's shop and rifle through not just the records, but pretty much everything they want. Just because Ohio law says that Jeremy needs to keep basic records of what animals come in and when they go out. But if that's the case, if that was true, then pretty much every business would have to forfeit its right to be secure entirely to go into business at all. And we know that's not the case. The Supreme Court has said that's not the case. Supreme Court has said outside of very, very narrow circumstances, go get a warrant.
So why does the state of Ohio think that they can do this? You know, they obviously feel very comfortable walking around, despite the fact that, as Josh mentioned earlier, this is very clearly, I mean, the line here between the business and the family property seems to be very murky one, given the way that he's built it himself, the way that he uses it for his family, how close it is to his family property. What is it that makes the government so confident in their ability to just come in the way that they did in Jeremy's case?
Yeah, well, what they're relying on here is something called the closely regulated industries doctrine or exception to the warrant requirement. And we know that because the investigator who came in and served Jeremy with summonses, when Jeremy was asking him, you know, how this was all okay, he says, well, this is a highly regulated industry. And so, you know, this is all kosher under the Constitution and we're allowed to do this. And I think they're misrepresenting the doctrine, but to take it back to what the doctrine actually is so that we can kind of grasp why they feel they have this grounding for what they're doing. In the late 60s, there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Katz. And, you know, we don't have to go too deep into Katz, but the takeaway from that decision was that the Supreme Court was going to start treating the Fourth Amendment as if it was centered around the concept of privacy, and in particular, this idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy. And in the 70s, there was a series of cases involving business regulation and inspections, so inspections of firearms manufacturers and alcohol sellers and those kinds of businesses, where the court said, well, when people enter these industries, these traditionally and highly regulated industries, they have a reduced expectation of privacy in their business shops, their premises, right? Their property. Even though it's property, which is a traditionally very protected thing under the Fourth Amendment, because of Katz, the Supreme Court started saying, well, you know, there are other things at play. There's this concept of reasonable expectation of privacy. And so you've got kind of a reduced constitutional interest in this space. And that exception, over time, got more and more watered down. So, and the kind of big case in this space that really formalized the way the Supreme Court started to treat it was called Berger in the late 80s. And you can think of Berger as kind of formalizing the way that the Supreme Court treated this closely regulated industries analysis. So the general rule is that warrants are required to conduct a search under the Fourth Amendment. That, as Rob was saying earlier, applies to business premises, and in particular, the non-public space of a business premise. Under this kind of Berger framework, the way that the closely regulated industries exception to the warrant requirement operates is that there's kind of two basic steps. There's a threshold inquiry of, does your business fall into the category of being closely regulated, or sometimes it's called pervasively regulated? And if it does, then we're going to apply this kind of three-factor test for deciding whether the warrantless inspection regime is constitutionally reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And the three factors are basically, is there a substantial government interest underlying the inspection regime? Are warrantless inspections necessary to further that interest? And then finally, does the scheme, the regulatory scheme itself, provide an adequate substitute for a warrant? Namely by constraining the discretion of the inspecting officers as far as the timing, the frequency, the duration, and the scope of the inspections. And We can talk more about like what's happened recently, but that's kind of the general framework of how the closely regulated industries doctrine originated and developed. And that is that system, that framework is kind of what these inspectors think justifies, you know, their course of action here.
So it seems to me, non-lawyer, just normal person, that there's a pretty big difference between alcohol-related industries and mining. I mean, mining is one of the most dangerous things I think that you can do as a job, and taxidermy. And as you describe these different prongs of the test, it all sounds very squishy. So, you know, I can see, I guess, on the part of the inspectors, how in their mind they're like, well, we have like me, for instance, as the inspector of this industry, that must mean it's regulated. Therefore, this applies. I mean, how do they, when you're the person on the ground, how is it reasonable to expect them to make those distinctions for themselves about when it's regulated enough?
Well, I don't think it's reasonable because they're the ones doing the inspections and they're the ones who have entrenched interest in enforcing the regulatory regime. So anyone employed in any particular government agency is going to think that the regulations they're enforcing are the most important ones, right? They're absolutely crucial for the protection of the public, and therefore these are essential regulations. This is a closely regulated industry because, of course, I'm the inspector closely regulating you, right? Now, traditionally, the way that the U.S. Supreme Court had kind of in the early cases involving this, as you mentioned, there's mining. I mentioned liquor and firearms. These are what the Supreme Court in a recent case called Patel has called ultra hazardous industries, right? These are industries that, you know, present some kind of clear and obvious risk to the public health or safety, such that if you can't go in and do a warrantless inspection immediately, you know, there might actually be a harm to the public, right? The Berger case was kind of an outlier there because Berger involved junkyards. And that's actually a huge turning point in the doctrine because junkyards are just places where a bunch of scrap metal hangs out, right? It's not like they could explode or something like that. It's not like they could, they could poison people by ingest the alcohol, right? Because there's no alcohol there. There's no substance they're ingesting. It's just a pile of scrap. And so once the Supreme Court did this in the late 80s, there was a series of cases in the lower courts. The doctrine kind of just exploded, where basically the rule became, if the industry is regulated, it is pervasively regulated, it is closely regulated, and therefore this exception is triggered, right? That's the way that it's basically worked. Now, the Patel case that I mentioned in 2015 was a huge turning point here because the court signaled that it was trying to cabin this doctrine. In 2015, the court said hotels that were required to keep records, just like Jeremy Shop in this case, that is not a closely regulated industry just because it's being required to keep records. It doesn't have the hallmark of a closely regulated industry. It's not ultra hazardous. It doesn't present a risk to the public health or safety. It's just a hotel. It's required to keep records. And so, I mean, I think Rob and I and other lawyers across the country looked at that decision and said, wow, like this is a big cabining of this doctrine. It's the Supreme Court is paring back this doctrine. But what we've seen since Patel is that lower courts have continued to treat the doctrine as if, you know, if it's regulated, it's closely regulated. We see that in all sorts of decisions. There's a recent case for those who are really interested called Kilgore out of the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit basically held, well, because massage therapy salons are regulated, they are licensed, therefore they're closely regulated. So we still have a lot of work to do in this space.
Well, speaking of exceptions, one of the things that I thought was interesting in Ohio and in the context of Jeremy and his shop is that it seems that his rights and the way that the government officials have to treat his rights is different if they actually suspect him of wrongdoing versus when they assume that he's innocent. Rob, can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's crazy that ODNR, the Department of Natural Resources, the regulations let officers do warrantless inspections except when they actually have suspicion that something illegal might be afoot. Because in those situations, if they have a good reason to believe that a shop contains illegally hunted animals, they can go to the shop and say, hey, we think there's good reason to believe you have illegally hunted animals. We'd like to come in. And in that situation, if the taxidermist or processors didn't want them to, they could actually say no. And then the only option for the officers would be to go get a warrant. Which, so that shows how this turns everything upside down. When we suspect you of something, we have to jump through all these hoops. But when we don't really suspect you of anything, when we're just on a fishing expedition, hunting for, you know, random violations, we can come in, we have carte blanche, we can do whatever we want. That gets the entire concept of the Fourth Amendment, of our personal security, flips it upside down.
So how does that square with what Josh mentioned, the attitude that this inspector had, where if he's coming in and he is clearly and explicitly by his own account fishing for wrongdoing, how, if that's his approach to it, his mentality and what he's actually on the premise to do, doesn't that mean he should have a warrant, or does that matter at all?
Well, it means that he's not there to actually, he's not really trying to just further the government's regulatory interests. What he's trying to do is he's fishing for violations of the criminal law. He's hunting for, and in that situation, that's exactly when we want people to go get a warrant if they're going to investigate for things like that. We don't want to let government officials basically on their own say-so go on these fishing expeditions where they're looking for, without any suspicion of anything, they're just looking to see if there's anything wrong that they can cite you for. That no one can feel secure in that situation, that at any moment, you know, the wildlife officer might bust in and tear your whole business upside down.
Is what that exception in Ohio, is that a common sort of exception? Does that apply in states and industries other than just in taxidermy? Or is that sort of dichotomy that you're describing between that suspicion of wrongdoing versus coming in just as part of a routine inspection where you're assuming the person is innocent? Is that something that happens more broadly nationwide, or is that really kind of isolated to Jeremy's circumstance?
I wouldn't say it's isolated at all. I think as Josh noted, in the after the Berger case in the late 80s, the lower courts drastically expanded the number of industries that were subject to warrantless inspections. And even after the Patel decision, where the Supreme Court explicitly said, hey guys, we only ever approved 4 industries, and hotels aren't in it, you know, we still kind of saw that expansion of this warrantless inspection authority. So unfortunately, a lot of times businesses are treated with fewer Fourth Amendment rights than criminals.
So are there business inspections that IJ, that you're, or rather that I guess maybe you, Rob, or you, Josh, think do pass constitutional muster? I mean, what is it? Are you comfortable with those early exceptions that the Supreme Court drew for those like very closely, when they were the truly closely regulated industries? Or do you think that introducing that at all, just that this was an inevitable can of worms that the court opened there and they shouldn't have introduced it in the first place?
Well, I think that there are some limited instances where the government could reasonably come in, do a warrantless inspection. But that has to be very tightly circumscribed, both as to what kind of business. I think the court early on, some of the early cases, the mining, the liquor, maybe the firearms, where they're ultra hazardous. I think that's the touchstone. It has to be an ultra hazardous business in order to avoid a warrant. Because at the end of the day, the only time we always want the courts involved. We want them to be issuing warrants. The only time we want to avoid that is when there's not enough time. And as a consequence of that, that'll be a huge negative consequence if we don't act immediately. So if they very tightly circumscribe the businesses to ones that are actually truly ultra hazardous, and then impose real constraints on when they can enter, how they can enter, what they can do while on the property, that might pass constitutional muster, but that's a far cry from what we have here in Ohio, where taxidermy, like Josh said, it's not even substantively regulated. And Officer Dodge and the other wildlife officers, they can do whatever they want, whenever they want.
Yeah, and one useful way to think about what Rob is describing with ultra-hazardous industries is by analogy. So like you may be familiar, if you're watching this, with the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement, which is really just, you know, it's an exception that says if there is an immediate threat to the public health or officer safety, and there's no time to get a warrant, right? So there's a time element at play. Police have to act now. That's maybe a limited situation where an officer can not get a warrant and decide in that moment, I'm going to search or I'm going to seize or I'm going to arrest, right? But in the context of, you know, just a business operating, there's not usually an exigency, right? There might be in situations where the industry is ultra hazardous, but in general, what we have is just people earning an honest living, working as hard as they can, just like normal Americans, and just doing that very American activity isn't the kind of thing that you should be forfeiting your rights by engaging in. And you know, the point of requiring a warrant, as Rob was saying, is to circumscribe the discretion of an officer, right? So the warrant is really this frontline safeguard against kind of the arbitrary assertion of authority of an officer just showing up and saying, let me in, I have a badge, right? We don't want officers in the field having unilateral authority to make those decisions and those assertions of power. And so, you know, if we're not going to require a warrant, what we want is a system that at least provides some of those same safeguards, which is why I think part of the kind of Berger analysis, the three-part test, the last prong there is adequate substitute for a warrant, constraints on timing, frequency, and duration. Those are the kinds of things that if the system has them, it makes them much more reasonable under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, that's an interesting the way to look at it, because as we were talking earlier and as I was reading about this case, one of the sort of alarm bells that went off for me is if the way that the courts come to look at this is, well, how regulated is this industry? It seems like if you're the government, the natural ratchet to pull is not to constrain yourself or to go get a warrant, but to just pile more regulations on the industry. And then you say, oh, well, you know, taxidermy, we're not going to do just record keeping anymore. We're just going to regulate that to pieces. And then we can do whatever we want to ensure that animals aren't being illegally hunted or whatever it is that they think is the important public interest that's being served. When you bring a case like Jeremy's case, are you at all concerned that you could have some unintended consequences in that direction where if you don't prevail or, you know, while the case is going on, the legislature or the regulatory bodies intervene and they're like, no, look, Your Honor, we actually, since they filed this, have just ramped up our regulation. And so this whole, all of their arguments, they don't apply anymore because now we know this is a business we care about a lot. Is that something that you think about when you bring these cases?
What we certainly think about the potential consequences of bringing our cases, but that's not one that I worry about here because, well, basically for the reasons we've been discussing, I think the ultimate objective of the case, or at least one of them, is to get courts to recognize that this threshold question of whether an industry belongs in the closely regulated box is actually an objective inquiry, right? One that turns on the nature of the industry itself, such that the government can't just decide to ratchet up its regulation and therefore water down your Fourth Amendment protections unilaterally, right? The government doesn't get to, you know, ratchet up or down your constitutional rights. Those are independent of decisions that lawmakers make.
Well, they should be.
Yeah.
So how does this case fit into a new project that you both are on the forefront of launching at IG, which is a project on the Fourth Amendment more broadly? You know, it's clear that there is a lot of legal history here dealing with the way that businesses are protected or not by the Fourth Amendment. Why is this something that you felt was important to do as you put that project together?
Well, the purpose of the Fourth Amendment Project is it's really to protect all Americans' rights to be secure. But one of the things we're doing is we're focusing on target specific areas within the Fourth Amendment that really need attention, be rehabilitated. And the closely regulated business exception is one of those. Because after all, that affects businesses. A lot of people sometimes, when they think about the Fourth Amendment, they think about criminals and, you know, and crime. But Jeremy's no criminal. He's an entrepreneur. He's created jobs for his community. He's created a respectable business. And that's why we're fighting for ordinary folks like Jeremy. The whole point of the Fourth Amendment is to preserve our security and peace of mind in our own property and to ensure that the government officials don't arbitrarily invade that. And so that's this case, some of our other cases challenging the open fields doctrine and other areas, We're looking at cases that affect real people who just want to live their lives and be let alone.
Well, thank you so much for joining me for today's deep dive. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the conversation, you can find more like it wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. IJ's work is made possible by people across the country who provide the financial support to do what we do. I hope you will consider joining them.